Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, here's a question to consider. Should garages be able to be turned into living spaces? It's happening in Dearborn, and a possible clampdown in city ordinances is causing concern. Plus, just how much land should we preserve for our kids and grandkids? We'll take a look at one group successfully saving Northern Michigan's natural treasures. And we speak with a former Marine sniper scout who's now a student at Michigan State University. He's made a film honoring his fallen comrades. But first, there has been a firestorm of protest in Highland Park after the discovery that a collection of history books, film, and tapes and other equipment from the city's high school had been tossed in the trash. Some 50 protesters gathered outside the high school in Highland Park. A member of the school board has quit, and several people climbed into dumpsters to retrieve what they could. The protest appears to focus not only on the discarded books, but on the way Highland Park School District's emergency manager, Donald Weatherspoon, is running things. We begin by turning to one of those people who searched through the dumpsters to retrieve as many books as possible. He's a Highland Park resident. He's an historian who helped to build the collection of Black history books, videos, and movies. Paul Lee joins us from Highland Park. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. It's an honor.
Tell us about the collection. Paul, what was in it?
Although newspaper reports have described the high school library as such, it in fact was so rich that it favorably compares with a good community college library and in some respects even a university graduate library in terms of its diversity, range, and depth. And the core of it was a collection on global Black history and culture. And I emphasize that because it wasn't just African American. It also covered the entire continent of Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean. And there was a substantial collection on indigenous or Native American history and culture. And you know that's important because many people who are described as African American are actually as much Native American in their ancestry as they are African.
So this was pulled together, and we've seen reports that the collection was in the range of 10,000 pieces. Is that accurate?
The last time that I saw it, my best site estimate was 10,000 volumes, which, by the way, is larger than when I first confronted the library. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, in the wake of the modern civil rights and Black power movements, Black communities throughout the United States began requesting that their school districts incorporate what was then called Black studies. The reasoning was that many African Americans, especially young persons, were doing damage to themselves and to others because they lacked a sense of value. And Black studies was designed to build a sense of self-esteem or self-worth. The essential idea was that if they respected themselves, they would respect others. And that was the genesis of this library. So we had an enlightened school board at the time, enlightened school administrators, very capable librarians, and also dedicated teachers who began to request materials. I happened to be the first class that was taught Black studies. This is 1974. And I was also the first class to be able to use that library. And my work as an historian since then is based upon the library that I was first exposed to way back in 1974.
So how did you hear that these materials that you helped to build, this library, how did you hear they'd been thrown away?
An old friend, Earl Wheeler, who's a former president of the Highland Park City Council, called me around 9 o'clock at night. His daughter, Linda, who taught in the school system for years, had been told by a parent something that none of us wanted to believe, namely that books were being thrown in a dumpster behind the Scott High School. So a friend and I went up there with a flashlight, hoping against hope that this was mistaken. When I climbed into the dumpster and looked down, I'm sorry.
It's hard for you.
A library that provided the basis for my scholarship helped mold my life and affected and enriched the lives of so many others. Was laying there under broken audiovisual equipment, which I also helped order. Let me give you, again, a little background. 20 years after the Black Studies was introduced in the Highland Park's curriculum, the school system decided that it should be enhanced, particularly in terms of audiovisual materials. By this time, I had started working in television. For 12 years, I worked in New York for the second longest running Black Affairs program. And I've been working for public television doing documentaries like for the American Experience, Frontline, and Nova since 1998. So I was brought back in to suggest audiovisual materials. And to my amazement, this infusion committee, it was called, accepted 100% of my recommendations. So I ordered VHS cassettes, the VHS videos, educational audio cassettes, and even old newsreels. You're probably too young to remember that. I mean, film strips.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so there were hundreds of these. After they accepted my recommendation for the AV materials, then they requested for me to recommend books and periodicals. So the library that I had used in 1974 grew considerably, and that's when I said the last time that I saw it, it was 10,000 volumes. Then they asked me to make recommendations for the construction of a media center to play these audiovisual materials. So I requested 3/4-inch and 1/2-inch video recording decks, reel-to-reel decks, audio cassette duplicators, and that stuff was thrown into this dumpster with such force. I'm certain that much of it was in good working order, that it was cracked to pieces, and the books were under this mass of ruined audiovisual equipment.
So you were able to retrieve how much, Paulie?
You know, Cindy, of 10,000 volumes that I saw last time I was in the library, we recovered less than 1,000.
And
we recovered less than a dozen of the audiovisual materials. And the state-imposed emergency manager offered a public apology, but no explanation. He only said that contractors were hired to consolidate records. Well, how does consolidation of records equal throwing out a library? The contractors couldn't make the distinction, and there's been no explanation. He claims publicly that some of the materials were recovered. Well, parents went in and took photographs and showed them to me, and the only thing that I saw was a small portion of our reference section, so it's encyclopedias, dictionaries, and gazetteers. But in terms of the core collections on black people and Native Americans, I saw nothing, and our fear is that 9,000 volumes ended up in a landfill.
So do you not believe what he tells you as far as what happened and why that happened?
I was born in Detroit and raised in Highland Park, which means that I tend to be cynical about what appointed or political officials tell me. It would be very simple to prove this by simply showing us this. And we have seen no evidence that this stuff was saved or recovered. Worse, we found out from some parents that in the same high school where these materials were thrown into a dumpster was the Highland Park City Archives, which went back to the 19-teens, which means they're a century old. This is distinct from the books. Now, why many of the books were rare first edition imprints, those city archives would be irreplaceable. There would be no doubles. And a parent went into the room where they were, and it was completely cleaned out. And the emergency manager has yet to tell us whether it was moved or whether that, too, was in a landfill. But again, you very brilliantly stated in your introduction that this has gone well beyond books, because it turns out that the emergency schools manager is liquidating all of the educational assets of Highland Park. That includes properties, I mean school buildings, equipment, supplies, as well as the library. This includes two relatively new school buses, the cars that were used for driver's ed, kitchen equipment, copiers. These things were sold off with supposedly to retire the school's debt without citizens being advised or offered the opportunity, for example, to bid on things that might have some personal meaning to them.
They were put
on eBay with the bidding price of some of these articles starting at one penny.
Let me just put this out here, because we've watched this story unfold in other parts of Michigan as well, Paul, with an emergency manager coming in with one mission, and that's to get the financial ship righted and to do things that are uncomfortable and painful for residents. Is this any different?
Yes, because it includes the heritage of a city. And in the case of the core collection on African Americans and Native Americans, that's the heritage of a people. And it wasn't offered, for example, as you know, recently there's been talk of the Detroit emergency manager selling off assets of the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is one of Detroit's jewels, where our jewels weren't offered for sale to retire this alleged debt, but were thrown in a dumpster. This was done without the citizens being consulted. I'm absolutely certain that he had no idea of the value of that library, and he didn't ask. I haven't moved. I still live in Highland Park, and many of the people who are on the Infusion Committee do. And the callousness of it to dispossess a community of its heritage, In my opinion, this goes well beyond any mandate conferred upon him by Governor Snyder in the state legislature.
In our last minute, Paulie, give me a sense. What could be done to make this right, in your view?
Most Highland Parkers now believe that the return of the school district needs to return to the citizen. That emergency management in Highland Park and these other cities you mentioned has turned out to be an unmitigated disaster. Rather than retiring debts, because Highland Park's debt has ballooned since he's been here, it's causing great destruction and great pain.
Paul Lee of Highland Park, who helped to build the 10,000-piece collection of history books, movies, videos, and other audiovisual equipment, and he helped to retrieve about 1,000 items when that collection was tossed in the trash. Paul Lee, thank you for talking with us today on Stateside.
Cindy, thanks again for helping us to tell this story.
Coming up next, the emergency manager of the Highland Park School District responds to the critics who say tossing out those books and materials is one more sign of disinvestment in urban areas. And then, how to preserve land and resources for future generations. That story comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. We're joined now by the emergency manager of the Highland Park School District, Donald Weatherspoon. Mr. Weatherspoon is also the manager of Muskegon Heights Public Schools in West Michigan. Mr. Weatherspoon, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, sir, why those thousands of books and audiovisual materials wound up in the trash? How did that happen?
First of all, I don't think your numbers are correct. You say thousands. There were several books were discarded. Several books were assorted. And the books, perhaps, that you're talking about were the books that were sorted.
We heard from Mr. Paul Lee, who claims to have helped put this collection together and felt that there was in the neighborhood of 10,000 pieces. Do you dispute that?
Yes, I do.
Why so?
Because I haven't seen a catalog list of any of the books that existed in the district. And if there is such a catalog, I'd like to see it. And if anyone has books that they believe belong to the district, we'd appreciate that they would be returned so we can include them.
How did materials wind up in the trash? I know you've described that as a mistake. What was behind that?
The books and records were in a deteriorating state. That's how this started.
So there was a sense of, let's clean this up and organize this?
Clean it up, organize it, and secure it.
Where is it secured, sir? You said it's in one location.
The old media center in the high school.
Is it accessible to anyone in the public who might want to see the materials?
It is not accessible at this point in time because I'm still having people in there cataloging. Now, ultimately, yes, we can have people come and they can take a look. It's not a public library. This will be where the administrative offices are also combined into the media center. So everything's combined into one spot. Remember, the school district is not in operation.
Now, we've seen the protesters on Woodward. You've got a member of the school board has resigned. I'm wondering, sir, how do you respond to critics who say that all of this that's happened involving these books and materials is just one more sign of disinvestment in urban areas like Highland Park?
I say just quite the absolute opposite. Highland Park basically received an extension of life through the program that's been put in place as far as addressing the deficit that is, like I said, in excess of $20 million, and the district will be able to regain control of its school district when the debt is repaid. Now, based on the tax revenues that are used to repay that deficit, it's going to take several years.
That was Donald Weatherspoon, emergency manager for the Highland Park School District. To many in Michigan and the tourists who visit, the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore is one of the most beautiful parts of pure Michigan. In fact, ABC's Good Morning America named the Sleeping Bear Dunes as the most beautiful place in America. part of that national lakeshore is South Manitou Island. And some people with very special ties to South Manitou Island have been very busy getting the place spruced up and polished for a special day tomorrow. Joining us is the granddaughter of James Putnam Burdick. He was the longest-serving lighthouse keeper on South Manitou Island. Pat Kelly joins us now from South Manitou's Ranger Station. Pat, tell us a little more about your grandfather.
He was an assistant keeper for a while, and he left South Manitou in about 1905, and then he went to Grassy Island Lighthouse in Wisconsin. Then he got his keeper's designation, so he transferred back to South Manitou, and he was a keeper here from 1908 to 1928.
And that had to have been a time when he really was, it was an important job. Lives depended on him doing that job properly.
Yeah, they were called the life-saving service, the U.S. life-saving service, and that was their main thing. This was a huge shipping area, and yeah, their main thing was watching for the boats and watching for anybody in distress. The Manitou Passage is a very beautiful area, but can be very treacherous due to shallow waters and shoal. But on South Manitou Island, there is a huge bay. It's called Crescent Bay. And it's the deepest safe harbor between Chicago and the Straits. So many times during storms of that, ships would tuck into the bay here to get out of the storms and the weather. Sometimes they made it, sometimes they didn't. So there's, I don't know exactly how many, but there's a lot of shipwrecks around the island due to that.
A lot of history on in a beautiful, beautiful spot. And if someone was thinking of making a visit to South Manitou Island, it looks like tomorrow would be a very extra special day to go. What is happening on July 10th?
Oh, tomorrow is going to be special. Right now, there are nine descendants that are volunteers. The nine descendants are descendants of four different lighthouse keepers. And that's the first time this has happened. And then tomorrow, three other descendants of lighthouse keepers are going to be here. So there'll be a total of 12 descendants here. And 10 of us are volunteers altogether.
And you've been working to really get things spiffed up. What have you been doing?
Well, the main thing that we needed to do and we wanted to do for tomorrow is to get the Fog Whistle Building, which is a building right next to the lighthouse. We wanted to get that all spruced up and painted. It hadn't been painted in over 20 years. It was really in a lot of disrepair, and it just needed some tender, loving care. And we got probably about four or five coats of real good paint on that. The paint was donated by a company in Traverse City, Sherwin-Williams. They donated all the paint to us, and we got caulking from them and some shirts and things like that, so that was a huge help. And so we went through about 20 gallons just on that building alone. Also, I've been up here doing the mowing of the historical farms and the village area. I do most of the mowing up here. I come up here, you know, I go home for a week and come back up here for a couple weeks and do this.
What do you love most about South Manitou?
I can't even think of one specific thing. I really can't. When I come over on the ferry or on the park boat, I look for the lighthouse, and I kind of say hello to my family in my heart when I do that. Then I arrive here in the ranger station, and getting greeted by the people that work here is really nice because I've been doing this for over 20 years. So the people here that work here for the park are real wonderful, and we've got a great partnership with the park and the volunteers. The farms are just beautiful. It's the whole complex is just, you know, in my heart. I can't even think of one specific thing.
And to someone who's never visited South Manitou, tell them why they should go visit.
Why they should go visit? Because it's the most beautiful place they'll ever go. And I say that in all honesty. The weather here, it's usually about 10 degrees cooler than on the mainland. So when it's hotter in Hades over on the mainland, it's a very comfortable here, the weather. To see the farms and the old growth cedars, it used to be a big logging industry over here. And on the northwest, maybe the southwest side of the island, it's very high ground, and they could not harvest those cedar trees. So there are some out there that are hundreds of years old, and it's just the lands of the giant cedars. And that's a spectacular thing to look at.
Pat Kelly is the granddaughter of the longest-serving lighthouse keeper on South Manitou Island. He served from 1908 to 1928. She and other descendants of lighthouse keepers will be touring the island tomorrow, and the public is welcome to join in. And that means you get a rare chance to go into the lighthouse keeper's living quarters there on South Manitou Island. Pat Kelly, thanks so much for talking with us and taking us on a tour of South Manitou Island.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
One of the things we most like to do here on Stateside is highlight success stories in Michigan, share with people what's working well and why. Well, one of those Michigan success stories is the Little Traverse Conservancy. If you've enjoyed the beauty of northern Michigan, it's a good bet the Little Traverse Conservancy had something to do with it. It's one of the oldest nature conservancies in the state. We often hear talk about rebuilding Michigan, but what about preserving it? Well, let's talk now with Tom Bailey. He's the executive director of the Little Traverse Conservancy, and he joins us from Petoskey. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Tom, you are closing in on, it's got to be hard to believe, 30 years as executive director. What do you think, Tom, has been the biggest success of the Little Traverse Conservancy over that time?
Well, I think it's the fact that the Conservancy was uniquely created as an organization to help people in a community work in what I think Adam Smith would have referred to as their own enlightened self-interest. And it combines conservation with economics, with quality of life. Obviously, we're a resort and tourist area here, so natural beauty is important. Our number one industry here is the tourist and recreational business. But also, those of us who live up here live here because we like it. We like the outdoors. We like the natural beauty. For some, it's hunting. For some, it's mushrooming. For some, it's birding. You know, all sorts of interests. But the one thing that we all have in common is the beautiful land around here. That's why we're here in the first place. So the way I like to put it is that the Conservancy sort of demonstrates that land conservation is not only good business, it's good for business.
So it's not just conservation for conservation's sake.
Right. I'm sort of famous in this business, I guess, for asking my staff and every project that we do, when we talked about protecting land, I always ask two questions. Protect it from what and for what? A lot of times the from what question comes easily. People say, well, you know, we don't want development. We don't want subdivision. We don't want signs and billboards. We don't want, you know, gravel pits and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But when you say for what, certainly it's for nature for its own sake. I mean, we need natural land. We need to maintain our water quality and our forests and so on. But I think it goes deeper than that, and it's for people. It's for us to enjoy. One of the things we do is offer education programs every season of the year, and we take anywhere from 4,000 to 7,000 children out on our preserves every year to learn about the outdoors in the outdoors. And so I think, you know, those things that we're preserving it for the scenic views, for people to take a hike, it enhances just the inherent value of nature itself, which is certainly important, but it personalizes it. It brings it home. It puts us directly in not only in touch with nature, but involved with it and as a part of it. And so, you know, I'd like to think that we're helping to confirm that the land is a community to which we belong, as Aldo Leopold put it, and that what we're doing through the Conservancy is helping people to recognize and enjoy that.
Well, your group at Little Traverse Conservancy, you have some unusual nature preserves that don't fit the typical mold. You look into urban areas and you're able to do that. Talk to us about those, because it's something that other groups and other communities can learn from.
You know, a lot of us, when we were growing up, whether we lived in rural areas or in town, I think most of us had some sort of an experience of a place where we went to enjoy the outdoors. You know, maybe it was just a couple of vacant lots in the city, or maybe it was a stream crossing down the road, or a park or something. But one thing that a lot of people have in common is that when we were growing up, there was a green open space that we went to, and we had adventures, and we learned, and we grew, and we played with our friends, and so on. And so that idea of keeping nature close at hand for everyone is one of our driving principles. So that applies not only, you know, to the sweeping 2 miles of frontage on the Great Lakes that are, you know, several miles out of town, but also just a couple of acres in town where there are woods and wetlands and places where people can have adventures or just get away from the hustle and bustle. All of those things are important to make sure that we have natural areas close at hand for everyone.
Tom, what do you see as the biggest threats to land preservation in Michigan right now in 2013?
Well, one of the things that I say about the biggest challenge that we're facing in land conservation is actually reversing the institutional momentum of manifest destiny. And that sounds like a big thing when I say it, but what I'm referring to there is the fact that most of our institutions relating to land, our governmental, legal, financial institutions that relate to land, were created in the 19th century when there was this attitude of expansion and manifest destiny, and land was sort of a commodity to be used, and it was seen as unlimited, and it was important to protect civilization from the ravages of the wild. Well, now in the 21st century, I think the tables have turned, and it's important to protect what's left of the wild from the ravages of civilization. And that institutional momentum that led to all of these incentives for development and building and everything, you know, may have made sense when there were fewer than 100 million people in this country and land was seen as unlimited. But now we're closing in on 350 million people in the country. We know that land is not unlimited. And in order to preserve our heritage as Americans and those open spaces, whether it's the woods of the Northeast or the prairies of the central heartland or the West Coast, all of these, the Great Lakes, we need to save what's left of those and not treat land the same way that we did in the 19th century. So that's an overriding principle challenge. I think more to the point in Michigan, as you asked, I think, you know, Governor Snyder has really hit on something when he said he wants to make Michigan the trail state. By that, he wants to connect everybody to recreational trails and natural areas, and that's at the heart of what we're trying to do here at the Conservancy, to keep nature close at hand for everyone. So I think that this challenge of completing our statewide trail network and enhancing it is a big one, to make sure that everybody in our state, particularly children who don't have driver's licenses, you know, that they can ride their bikes or walk or you know, push themselves on a longboard or whatever they do, rollerblade, to get to areas where they can enjoy some outdoor recreation, whether it's, you know, ball fields and playgrounds or natural areas with streams and hills and trees to climb and things to enjoy. The third challenge I would say that faces us in Michigan is a cultural challenge, and that is the fact that we're spending so much time looking at screens and televisions and computers and mobile devices that we need to remind ourselves to unplug once in a while, to hit the off button, to flip the silent switch, and escape to the outdoors. There's a guy named Richard Louv, L-O-U-V, who wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods. And in it, he documents scientific research that shows that children do better academically, socially, and cognitively if they spend more time outdoors. He's basically demonstrating through academic research what the poet Walt Whitman wrote about back in the 1860s when he wrote that the secret of making the best persons is to grow in the open air and to eat and sleep with the earth. You know, whether you believe the poet or the professor, it's true that it's good for us to spend time outdoors. And as Louv documents in his book, children today are spending a lot less time outdoors than previous generations, and it's not necessarily that healthy for them.
Tom Bailey is the executive director of the Little Traverse Conservancy, and you can learn more about them at their website at landtrust.org. And Tom was kind enough to join us from the Crooked Tree Arts Center in Petoskey. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you so very much.
Still to come, should garages be able to be turned into living spaces? It's happening in Dearborn, and a possible clampdown in city ordinances is causing some concern. And we speak with a former Marine sniper scout who is now a student at MSU. He's made a film honoring his brother Marines who did not come home from Afghanistan. That story in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Here's a question. Should you, as a homeowner, be allowed to do pretty much whatever you want with your garage as long as you don't bother the neighbors? Well, that's the essence of a growing debate in Dearborn, where a desire by some residents, largely Arab Americans, to use their garages as living space is being met with resistance at City Hall and the prospect of tighter garage ordinances. Jeff Karub is with the Associated Press covering issues pertinent to the Arab Muslim community, and he joins us from the AP offices in Detroit. Welcome to Stateside, Jeff.
Thank you, Cindy.
Describe for us, Jeff, what is being done to retrofit these garages?
Well, what you have are ordinances that haven't been updated for quite some time in Dearborn. And what they're trying to do is bring these ordinances up to the present day and take into account how garages are being used today. The way the ordinance is written, very generally speaking, is that the garage is designed for the storage of vehicles, for the parking of vehicles, and for the storage of the stuff that we kind of think of that belongs in a garage. And so what they're trying to do now is incorporate the changing society a bit, but they run up against some issues in the community as to how the garages are being used.
And what are they doing? What are residents doing that is causing some concern at City Hall?
Well, it's important to note that the garage has been a hangout place, if you will, for Arab Americans for decades. I mean, it goes back to that tradition of socializing and gathering. And the largest place that they could find in a lot of cases was the garage. And it might have been something just as simple as some lawn chairs in the garage. But what got the city's attention were some, just a couple of homes where they had installed sliding glass doors in front of the traditional electric garage door.
Mm.
And inside, you have a space that's very similar to a patio. Tiled floors, sort of wicker furniture, a TV in the garage. But what aroused interest, I guess you could say, was what were these sliding doors on two homes on the city's east side, which is now a predominantly Arab American area.
Okay. Now, when I hear you describe something that seems like a patio with maybe lawn chairs and tiled floors and maybe a TV, I have a hard time understanding why that's causing concern.
Well, it kind of gets back to what the garage was originally intended for. And the idea that a garage, according to the city, is not necessarily built to the same specifications or safety codes as the rest of the house. And the idea that if you can't put a car in there, then you're not using the garage for the purpose in which it was originally intended. The sliding doors suggest that this is becoming living space. And, of course, how do you define living space?
Mm-hmm.
That's something that the planning commission of the city is now grappling with. The city has a lot of concerns about parking. They don't want to clog the street with cars. They have safety concerns about the garage. But residents say, you know, we've been doing this kind of thing for a good long time, and it's not just Arabs. Many people have the so-called man cave in their garage, the TV, the home brewing,
yes,
this sort of thing. But it really was, the catalyst was a couple of homeowners who had put sliding doors, again, in front of the existing garage door.
I'm speaking with Associated Press reporter Jeff Karub, who covers issues pertinent to the Arab Muslim community and has been covering this growing debate in Dearborn, where you have some residents, largely Arab Americans, wanting to use their garages as living spaces. And that's being met with some resistance at City Hall, where they're looking at the prospect of tighter garage ordinances. And, Jeff, there was a Planning Commission meeting in Dearborn last night, and my understanding is Ron Paul's Libertarian Party has gotten involved. So tell us what happened.
Well, once again, the Planning Commission has tabled this rewrite. this proposed revision of the garage ordinance. The lawyers, city officials say, are still working on proposed changes. Now, I don't know what's going on, but I have to think that they're trying to take all of these concerns into account, because even though the issue started with members of the community who happen to be Arab American,
mm-hmm.
it does bring in, it does raise some of these issues. And the reason why a libertarian group is getting involved, I think, is because they're concerned that you start dictating what people can do in a garage. It becomes an issue of too much regulation, too much government, this sort of thing. And it does go well beyond the Arab community. But again, this is just where it started.
So they've tabled this because?
Well, the lawyers are still working on the language of this proposed garage ordinance. What will it say? What can it say that satisfies the city's need for safety and orderliness and keeping the streets clear and all of that, at the same time writing something that allows homeowners some discretion as to how their garage can be used? And as some of the city officials on the Planning Commission said last night, how do you define living space? The city talks about this as being, well, we don't want sleeping and cooking in our garages. And some of the residents I've spoken to say, well, we're not sleeping in our garage. We're not cooking in our garage. We use it, as one resident put it, for chilling purposes.
Which, as you point out, that idea of the man cave is not a new one. So many people will use their garages for that.
There's a member of the Planning Commission, he's actually the chairman, named Gary Arago, who told me that he doesn't think that the eventual restriction or eventual ordinance is going to be very restrictive, because he's concerned about the same things that the residents are. He says, you know, I think your home is your home. And he, in fact, is a car collector, and he's an artist. And these are activities that he does in his garage. Another non-Arab resident told me that she knows she and many of her other neighbors don't park their cars in their garage. You don't find a uniform tradition or uniform activity like that. A lot of people park their cars in their driveway. A lot of people park their cars on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't noticed a great clogging of streets in any one neighborhood of Dearborn, but I do see a lot of cars parked in driveways.
Jeff Krupp, I have to ask, how much of this objection in your heart do you think has to do with class or ethnic issues or undercurrents?
Well, it as always, depends on whom you ask. Arab Americans, and I don't say that all speak this way,
mm-hmm.
but there have been objections raised by not only residents of Arab American descent, but also an administrator and an instructor at Henry Ford Community College, who is an author and is an expert on the Arab American community historically in Dearborn, who says that he can't see it really as any other way than something that is akin to discrimination or harassment. The city says point blank, we are not harassing Arab Americans. We are not targeting Arabs or anyone else. We just want the garages to be used for their stated and safe purpose. So it may seem like a wishy-washy answer, but clearly the answer to that question is going to depend on what side of the issue you're on.
Jeff Karub reports on Arab-Muslim issues for the Associated Press. He joined us from their office in Detroit. Jeff, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
In October 2010, the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines deployed to Afghanistan. They were sent to relieve the British Royal Marines in the southern Helmand province, a hotbed of insurgent fighters and IEDs. 25 Marines in the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines did not come home. One of those who did went on to become a student at Michigan State University. Former Marine Sniper Scout Logan Stark is now a senior in MSU's professional writing program. As a class project, Logan formed a 3-member team They produced a documentary called For the 25, dedicated to his 25 fallen brothers in the Dark Horse Battalion, which suffered the highest number of casualties in 2010 during Operation Enduring Freedom. Logan Stark joins us now in the studio. Logan, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Logan, start by giving us some background. What drove you to become a Marine and to become a sniper?
The decision to become a Marine was kind of one that I just felt I needed to do. I had that urge to serve my country and to make that commitment and become part of the military.
So you were deployed to Afghanistan. You went with the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, the 3-5. Now, 3-5 took a lot of casualties right out of the gate. How did you handle that?
How did we handle that? We just...
How about you? How did you handle that when that was going on?
That's something you can't really do too much about. So you just got to remember what you're doing and what you're doing there. And you got to become better at your job while you're over there. And you got to not allow yourself to become deterred from the fact that you are taking these casualties. You have to continue to operate and do your job. You know, when you're in that sort of situation, it kind of focuses you and it gives you this ability to kind of hone in and really come to grips with what you're going through.
For yourself and for your brothers.
Right,
got to
exactly.
Do your job to the best of your ability. So you come back, and then as part of this course, Dr. Bump Halberter's course at Michigan State in the Professional Writing Program, you came up with this idea of making a documentary about this time in Afghanistan. Why were you willing to go back and revisit experiences that were so tough?
I had done a short film on my roommate and really good friend, Kevin, who was – he was with us, and he had gotten shot in the head. And I did this short –
And shot in the head and all right.
Yes, he survived.
Yes.
And I put this little six-minute short together, and I really liked the process. I liked sitting down to him. I liked reliving those moments for you. And that was – it was just kind of a good-hearted story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
we should hasten to let everybody know Kevin got shot in the head, but it was like he was fine. His helmet did its job.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so as I continued my studies in Michigan State, I got the opportunity to do the more advanced film work with Dr. Bump. And for this last class, this last semester, we were doing a project the whole semester. And the one requirement was that it had to be a good story. You just had to go find a good story. And I had finally come to the grips with the fact that, you know, I needed to write about what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I know. And I think that comes through in the finished product.
Let's listen to a clip from For the 25 as a Marine named Jordan describes his very first mission in Afghanistan very early in the morning.
We were in this cornfield and we saw the two, like, team leaders, I guess you would say, of that, like, insurgent group. And they had, like, their AKs and their radios, and they were pointing, like, where they were going to set up and stuff. And so we initiated contact and took out the two team leaders. And then just all hell broke loose. And then with the enemy on that point, they started maneuvering around us and just like getting us into a 180. And that's when I knew, like, this is going to be a whole different ball game. I mean, it's the very first day, 4 hours into the day, and you're already two clicks away from any help. And you're getting cut off and surrounded and moved on by the enemy at 7 in the morning, and there's nothing you could do about it.
I'm speaking with Michigan State University student Logan Stark. That clip was from his documentary called For the 25, speaking with fellow Marines from his service in Afghanistan. I'm wondering, Logan, how did the reality of being there in combat in the Helmand Province differ from what you expected as you were going through basic training?
It comes to a point where all the training you do is to work up to that moment when you are in combat. So you anticipate what it'll be like, and you try and imagine that, and you try and put yourself in that situation. In reality, you can't really prepare for it until you're there, but the training that you receive is what you have to rely on when you get in those situations.
You know, losing comrades in battle is a story that is as old as mankind. And so often in the past, soldiers were expected to come home and, you know, get a slap on the back, join the VFW, and get on with their lives. And today there is certainly a greater understanding of post-traumatic stress disorder. You actually began thinking of making this movie about PTSD, didn't you?
Yeah.
What was PTSD like in your life? What was going on for you?
It was really confusing. It was trying to readjust into this culture that I wasn't familiar with or had become defamiliarized with. And so you just kind of feel like an outcast. You feel like you don't really have anybody that you can relate to. And then there's, you know, there's other things. There's various symptoms that come along with it, and I think everybody's symptoms vary. But you really kind of got to realize that, oh, this is because of this. This isn't just something I'm going through. This is as a result of past experiences.
Let's take a listen to another clip from the documentary For the 25. Here are two of the Marines describing just the experience of being in Southern Helmand Province.
It's kind of a fight every single day just to make sure you get out of there, you know.
All right, get across. Let's go.
I was much more afraid of stepping on an IED than getting shot. The gunfights weren't as scary to me as just walking around. Some of the scariest patrols I went on, I never even got shot at. And I remember I would wake up and be like, I would look at my legs and be like, well, it's been a wild ride, but might not be walking back into base tonight.
I think what I want people to see is that these men are just men, and they have gone through hell, but they're really just people. And you know, that it's all going to be okay, you know, and just to kind of humanize all of this.
So how cathartic do you think it was for you and the other Marines who were in this documentary to sit down and share this, especially considering you had a couple of co-producers who were not Marines, had not been in combat, so you had kind of that civilian viewpoint?
I can't tell you how therapeutic it's been for all of us involved. Just coming to terms with everything and sitting down and, you know, once you put it out there, it's out there. You can't bring it back. And that kind of openness helps to deal with it, I think.
Logan Stark, professional writing student at Michigan State University. Thank you so much for talking with us and sharing this with
us. Thank you for having me.
Logan's documentary on his combat service as a Marine sniper in Afghanistan is entitled For the 25. You can find it on YouTube, and we have put a link to it on our website. So just go to the Stateside page on MichiganRadio.org. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Tony Brown. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.